Today's Taisho is Yang Shan Plants His Ho. Yang Shan Plants His Ho is case 15 in the Book of Serenity. Introduction. Knowing before speech is called silent discourse. Spontaneous revelation without clarification is called hidden activity. Saluting in front of the gate, walking down the hallway, this has a reason. What about dancing in the garden or wagging your head out the back door? Case, Guishan asked Yangshan, where are you coming from? Yangshan said, from the fields. Guishan said, how many people are there in the fields? Yangshan planted his hoe in the ground, clasped his hands, and stood there. Guishan said, on South Mountain there are a lot of people cutting thatch. Yangshan took up his hoe and went. Verse, the old enlightened one's feelings are many. He thinks of his descendants, but now he repents of having set up a household. We must remember the saying about South Mountain, engraved on the bones, inscribed in the skin, together requiting the blessing. Today is the second day of our autumn sesshin. It's a beautiful autumn day, not too cold, not too hot. The leaves are turning colors. It's raining outside. It's a very beautiful fall day. And this morning, everybody was doing a really excellent job in the zendo. Once again, people were sitting very still. Some of you are here for the first time, and I want you to know, especially if this is day two for you, that day two is likely to be the hardest day of the sesshin. Usually what happens on day one is that people are still working off of their energy, their usual energy. And their minds are busily thinking, and they're thinking about things that they left behind at work or in their families. And typically what happens is that as day one goes on, you begin to run out of your usual energy. And by the end of day one, you're probably pretty tired by around 9:30. Maybe the last hour on the meditation cushion, you were sort of between dream and waking, yes, and maybe the only thing keeping you from falling asleep completely was the pain in your knees, you know. Day two is definitely harder than that. And, you know, you get up in the morning and maybe you feel a little fresher because you have had some sleep and your muscles have repaired themselves a little bit. By around now, you're probably feeling like, how can I get through the day? You know? Now, I'd like to say something about this issue of the challenge, the physical challenge of the meditation practice. You might say, why are we doing this? You know, why not have more sleep, less meditation, and so on and so on. We could do things very differently. We could have gotten up at 7, and people could report, around 8, and we do zazen maybe for an hour, and then have breakfast. But I think that you would not be able to get into the deeper levels of your concentration. I really believe that. When you are using the whole body-mind as a unit, it makes a huge difference, I would say. This kind of meditation is based on the idea that a body and mind are a unity. This is really like one of the founding ideas behind yoga. So in the ancient Indian tradition, the idea was that body and mind are so intimately linked that the various asanas in yoga are productive of different states of mind. And so basically when you're doing yoga, you know, many people who have done yoga have had the experience of after working through a series of asanas, they're physically tired, but they feel mentally very purified. They go leave the yoga studio feeling very serene. And this is not an accident. I mean, you can get that same feeling from, say, jogging, but I think yoga is quite extraordinary in the kind of mental serenity it produces. And if you think about it, all the different asanas in yoga are producing different sorts of... It's like your body is a musical instrument, and when you get into the sun position or downward dog or something like that, you're activating different nerves, you're stimulating different muscles, and if the body and the mind are really like one system, then it's not so surprising that at the end of all this you would be very serene, very calm, and so on. We haven't really grasped, I think, this aspect of body-mind unity in America, because, you know, we understand yoga as like good for your fitness. It's a fitness routine. But there's more to it than that. It has to do with the intricate and subtle relationship between the nervous system as a whole and the world, you know. So the whole body is like an apparatus for receiving information. And normally our mental habits and our culture and so on block a lot of that information from reaching us, at least consciously. Basically we're trying to use the human body, the human being, as an instrument for receiving information, basically, you could say. And so we're sitting in this odd posture because, at least in theory, at least in yogic theory, this posture is the one that's most appropriate for waking up. So of all the asanas, the lotus posture is the supreme asana. It's associated with the activation of the maximum activation of the nervous system as an instrument of awakening. So when we're sitting on the cushion, this all could seem like a superstition, but I don't think it is. Obviously I don't think it is, or I wouldn't be here. I've been made aware in various ways of how different consciousness can be on and off the cushion. I think it's very subtle, but we don't necessarily appreciate this. You know, in Zen temples, people walk around barefoot all day, this might seem odd. You know, why don't people wear shoes? At least in Japanese Zen temples, and in fact, you'll see in Thai, in Southeast Asian temples too, monks and nuns don't wear shoes. And that might seem odd. You know, A few years ago, I was doing a yoga class for a bunch of inner city kids from New Brunswick. We have a summer program for them, and they asked me to do a, I think I might have said a yoga class, but I was asked to do a meditation class with a bunch of inner city kids. And most of these kids were Hispanic, and they were from South Mexico, southern Mexico. And when they all came in, we were going to meditate, and I asked them to take off their shoes. And a lot of them are from rural areas in Mexico, and their families have migrated to New Brunswick. And I said, how many of you like to take off your shoes? And they all raised their hand. And I talked about what it means to be barefoot, you know. And they all agreed with me. They were terrifically excited. You know, I said, shoes, you have to wear shoes, but, you know, you lose a lot of information when you wear shoes, you know. You don't get the texture of the ground underneath your feet, the temperature, you know, and so on. So when we take off our shoes and we walk around, we're getting more information, even if we're not paying attention to it. Maybe that's the reason Zen monks don't wear shoes. I don't know. Maybe there are other reasons. But the point is, when you put shoes on your feet, you close off. It's like suddenly you're deadening all that information. And in other ways, too, we deaden ourselves to a lot of information, not just, you know, like wearing clothes, but also in our mental habits and in our psychological habits, we close off a lot of information. There's lots of things we don't pay attention to habitually, and there's lots of things we don't pay attention to because they're associated with danger or make us feel uneasy. I remember going to a sesshin a long time ago. This was my first sesshin. And I have to tell you, it was really murder. It was murder. I'm always in awe of people who come to sesshin and they sit so well on their first sesshin, because my first sesshin was absolutely, by like day three, I was just barely able to crawl to the cushion, it seemed like. But I remember getting up, I guess one morning, and the other thing was I was also like a late riser. So getting up at 4:30 was like the end of the earth for me. It was just like, 4:30, my God, the middle of the night. And I got up and I went into the washroom. And we used to use we rented a summer camp on the Hood Canal. And somebody had come up with this idea of a big circular sink with all these taps coming down from the ceiling so lots of kids could all wash their face in one giant zinc sink, one giant metal sink. I've never seen anything like it, and probably it was one of the weirder plumbing arrangements I'd ever seen. But I came into this room and I turned on the taps and the water was drumming on the metal of the sink, and the light from the bulb overhead was catching the surface of the metal. And I also noticed that on the metal there was actually moss growing. And it was just the most amazing experience. It was like my senses were so open. I just felt I felt that my senses were unobstructed and clear in some way. And even now, 34 years later, I can remember that morning. And I've had many memories like that. I remember once we did a sesshin at another place. We rented some space at a Catholic place on Lake Washington, and they rented space to all kinds of groups. And we had a sesshin in one part of the building, and in another part of the building, there was like a prom. It was prom night. And we had to get to the cafeteria from where we were sitting, and we had been meditating all day. And we were going to the cafeteria, and we went through the hallway, and there were all these girls in their pink and blue dresses, and these guys in pink and blue tuxedos. And it was very hallucinogenic, I have to say. It was very weird. So we went from the world of Zen through the world of your high school graduation. And these kids were in awe of us, I think, and we were in awe of them, I guess. So we at the end of that session, however, I remember we drove away and we had to stop at a little store, and Bill Kugler, my friend, had to go into the quick check, and and I turned the radio on in his car, and there was just this bubblegum music on the radio, but it was so, it was like, you know, it was something like, "Oh, baby, I want your love," or something like that, you know. But when I heard it, it just went through me like it was like every atom in my being understood this person's longing and his anguish. And you know, if you heard the song, you might think I'm crazy, you know. It's just a bubblegum song. It's just this pop music. But I think all the emotional channels in my heart were opened up too, you know, and the music itself was just like, it was like Beethoven. It was so beautiful. You know, really. It was just, it seemed like, oh my God, that is breathtakingly beautiful. I don't think I was hallucinating. I just think the doors of perception were open, you know, and I was alive. I was awake. And this has happened to me many times, you know. Even on a Thursday night, or on a Wednesday night, rather, when we do our zazen, you know, at the end of three periods of meditation, you drink the tea, and it's just like, people have come up and said, "What is that tea? It's so good," you know. And it's really, the tea is good. It's really good tea from Taiwan. But what makes the tea really good is that you've just clarified your mind. So the theory behind all of this is that we can use the body-mind unity as an instrument for receiving information, and that basically the body is like a musical instrument, and that in different postures your states of mind are quite different, and basically people through trial and error in ancient India decided that this asana of the lotus posture was the one best suited to deep, sustained concentration and psychological openness. I suffered enormously when I started doing Zen because this was not easy for me. I have met people who come into the Zendo and they get into full lotus right away, and they just seem to have an easy time of it. And most of those people, by the way, don't stay in Zen. It's interesting, you know. But for me, it was really a challenge. And my first session, I was really like barely able to make it through one sit. But in retrospect, you know, after many years of practice, I realized that even though this was difficult, it was opening me up in many different ways. Not just my senses, you know, it was not just purifying the senses, but purifying the heart. You know, people after three or four days of sesshin are very open and gentle. It's like a lot of the barriers have fallen away, and people are more vulnerable, but more compassionate. You can see it sometimes in people's faces. There was a guy years ago who used to sit with us. He's moved away. But he had a lot of anger, you know, and it was a theme in his life, you know, and when we would talk, it was a theme. You know, he had a lot of rage. And he came to this session, this one session, and toward the end of the session, he came into Dokusan, and he was really like crying, you know. And I said, "What are you crying about?" And he said, "You know, my dog. I'm crying about my dog." And I said, "Well, what about your dog?" You know, and he said, "I mean to him sometimes. I yell at him, and I'm mean." And I was so happy to hear him say that he, you know, to see this breakthrough, right? Where, you know, basically, he's seeing his behavior, his compulsive behavior, in a new light. And he wasn't ashamed. I'm not sure that's the right word, you know, because I think shame is kind of self-centered, right? But this compassion was arising up from him, and he had become one with his dog, and he understood the dog's pain from the dog's perspective, you know. And I think he probably went home and treated the dog better, you know. And when the next session came, I imagine his dog came up and barked and said, "Go to session." Arf. Arf, arf, arf. That means go to session. Exactly. Yes. So anyway, it made a difference. It opened his heart, please. Bear with the prop. As I started this session by saying to people who are new and people who are old, trust the process. That this is really an amazing session, is an amazing invention. And you know, people go through a process that's really quite predictable. You can almost set your watch by it. Day two, people come into the Zen, you know, to Dokusan, and they'll say things like, you know, "I don't think I can make it," or they'll say, "I'm so unhappy, you know, I hate this," you know, or whatever. Not always, but, you know, maybe they're thinking that, you know. Sometimes people come into Dokusan and they're unhappy, they're miserable, what's wrong, I can't answer my koan, everything in my life is going to hell, and so on, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then it's like day three or day four, they come, "How are you doing? What's happening?" "Oh, it's wonderful. And that's the change of heart that happens in session. It doesn't always happen, but it often happens. And over the years, I've seen it again and again, you know. And people leave session with this kind of beautiful openness and connectedness. I must say, we live in a society that is not into this, you know. I mean, I always tell beginners, people come to sit, and I always say, if you try to do this on your own, you probably won't succeed. I mean, can you imagine trying to do session on your own? You think, okay, I'll do it. I'll get up at 4:30, I'll sit for an hour and a half, and I won't move, you know. I think it wouldn't happen, right? You need the structure. But anyway, I always tell beginners, you won't do this unless you have a structure and unless you practice and so on and so on. Anyway, I've lost my train of thought. So, what was I saying? Would somebody help me out? Was anybody awake? You can speak. It's okay.
The guy with the dog.
It's a dog. Oh.
The day four, you're happy.
Oh yes. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Anyway. This is a process that people go through, and it's predictable. By around day four, you will feel better. You will begin to experience a kind of opening up. That's the nature of this process. So, please trust it. Please give yourself over to it and realize that there is such a thing as karma, you know, actually, you know, we become very rigid and inflexible in our lives in various ways, you know. We become very armored and as I was saying, I think this is the thread I dropped, you know, our culture doesn't encourage a compassionate openness, you know. So as I say to beginners on Monday night, you never see a bus driving by and on the side of the bus it says, cultivate enlightenment, right? It usually says, buy this product. Our culture is really not a machine. Sashin is a machine for producing enlightenment. Buddhism is a machine for producing compassionate people. That's the goal. That's why it exists. But our culture, our mainstream culture, is really a machine for producing money. And so it's not particularly interested in compassion or even, I work for a university, so I'm kind of special. But my sister works for a very large commercial hospital. And I see, you know, she's a very wonderful nurse practitioner, and she's an oncology specialist. So she works with people who are dying, and I've seen, you know, my sister get really worked almost to death, you know, and she's had to pull back a little bit, and I have other friends too who are in the commercial world, and I see them just work to a frazzle sometime, and I realize, you know, if you're in the business world. And even in the university, it's true. If you said to yourself, I'm going to work 60 hours a week, I'm never going to ask for a raise, I will sleep in my office, and I'll start working as soon as I regain consciousness, you know, your boss would be thrilled, probably, right? You know, your company would say, this is the worker we want, right? So generally speaking, the standard of the culture is, we want people who will work very, 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 very hard and be very successful and make a lot of money. We don't necessarily want people who are compassionate, who are concerned about others, who put others before themselves, and so on and so on. So the values of our culture kind of pull against the values that we encounter, that we cultivate here on the cushion. And this goes very deeply. You know, our culture is very competitive, and you get hurt growing up. People aren't always supportive, and this leaves all kinds of injuries, scars on body, heart, and mind. And when you come to Sashin, you're sort of undoing all of that. Basically, this guy who used to yell at his dog wasn't really yelling at his dog. He wasn't really being mean to his dog. He was being mean to somebody who was mean to him. And basically, he started unraveling some of this in on the cushion. And of course, he may or may not have fully put all the pieces together, but he suddenly realized, my God, I've been cruel to this innocent dog, and so this is a real this is like a opening up process. This is really part of Zen practice, and it's like deconditioning. You get a message in society that you have to be competitive, you have to be tough, you need to be maybe even a little scornful of other people. And you come here, and usually we direct those lessons against ourselves. You know, we're scornful against ourselves. We're afraid of being open, and so on. So all of this goes into some of the pain we experience on the cushion. All of this goes into some of the rigidity we experience, even in our muscles. That sounds like baloney, but you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but when I first got to Rutgers, I had this very difficult job. And I was administering a very large program, and the person who had administered it before had not done a good job, so it was in great disarray. And in fact, this person who had hired me wanted me to fail. He hoped that when I failed, he would have to step back in and he would get the promotion he had not been given by the dean. And so I didn't really realize I had walked into a trap, you know. In fact, it was interesting. I thought it was suspicious because when the guy gave me my office, he hadn't cleaned out any of his stuff. Really, all his stuff. He left his ashtray there. It was like, the message was, you won't last more than, you know, 6 months or something. So I really wanted to do well at this job because I saw it as actually part of my practice. You know, my teacher had said, you know, your work is also your practice. You know, so I tried to take what I had learned on the cushion and bring it into my work. But the stress was so great. I would get this tension in the back of my neck, and it would go all the way up to the top of my head. It was like somebody had tightened the skin on my head until it was incredibly tight, and my muscles in my neck would get so sore and stiff that bending my neck actually was like screaming. This is the way tension can affect the body, you know. And I went to a doctor and I said, I'm having this incredible tension. And she gave me these relaxants that were, they were truly hallucinogenic. It was a horrible experience. It was like suddenly being a ghost. I took these pills and I had no body and I was sort of drifting a few inches above the ground. And so I stopped taking them, and I realized I've got to do more zazen, which helped. You know, here I am today. But those, you know, if you multiply that by many years, those kinds of stresses and injuries, they do leave a kind of trail on the body. And they're reflected in rigidities and blockages. That have a psychological dimension too, obviously, you know. And by the way, you know, there's a lot of studies now, I'm sure you know, that stress can produce a thickening of the walls of the arteries and a plaque gathering. So there's this body-mind unity. When we sit on the cushion, we're actually opening up the mind and the body together, and there's a lot of rigidity and so on, and you just have to realize this is like therapy. It's body-mind therapy. And you might say, well, my legs are killing me. This is some therapy. But please realize that the end result is going to be really quite wonderful. You know, in the meantime, what you have to do is just use your breath, focus on the pain, and sweep the pain away with your breath. So you know, if you begin to feel pain, you follow the breath out, and the pain diminishes. You know? And then you gather your breath again, and you'll notice probably there's some pain, and then you follow the breath out, and the pain goes away. And little by little, you'll notice that the pain begins to become more peripheral. And you'll feel like there might still be pain, but it will be rather like a whisper or an undercurrent, but it won't be this major focus of your attention. And then, you know, you might notice that after a period of sitting, your pain begins to diminish or even go away for a while. It'll come back. But you'll get off the cushion and you might walk into the dormitory and suddenly you'll feel, oh my God, I feel so relaxed. I feel so purified. See, this is really all a kind of yoga. By the way, you know, Zen is actually part of the Yogacara tradition, what's called the Yogacara tradition in Buddhism. We're the yoga people. You know, that we're noted as the meditators, in case you didn't notice. We practice meditation a lot. So, please realize that this is the case, that you're going through a process of body, mind, and heart purification. layers have been removed, you can experience the world in a fundamentally different way. Normally, we are living behind barriers, physical barriers, mental barriers, emotional barriers. And when we go through this process of opening up, we begin to experience a kind of energy, or it starts as this sense of purification or release. You're sitting on the cushion. There's this tremendous sense of compression. You're squeezing the breath. There's pain right at the edges of your consciousness. There's a kind of compression process going on. Right? And then you get off the cushion and you go into the dormitory and you suddenly realize, oh my God, I feel so open, so relaxed, and I feel so calm. And you might feel just this extraordinary calm that you might not have felt for months, Even on a vacation, if you go on a vacation, by the way, vacations are very nice, but if you go on a vacation, I'm just saying there's nothing wrong with enjoying yourself at a vacation, but if you go on a vacation, you might find that even if though you're on vacation, you still feel tense, I used to notice that myself. Somehow, when you're doing this, you might feel a kind of deep relaxation that is quite difficult to achieve under other circumstances. You may get off the cushion, and it's just like every barrier has fallen, at least for a little while. And that's like stage one, is beginning to get to that place where there's a kind of openness or deep relaxation. And then, if you can stay in that state for a little while, there can be a kind of energy flow where you feel very energetic, very jazzed, very... kind of like there's just a kind of gathering of energy in yourself, and you can tap into this energy, and it's quite joyous. Sometimes people have experienced the problem of late sesshin insomnia, and I have done this many times where, let me just say, this is a challenge for everybody involved. Last night, around 10 o'clock, I was really tired. I had a big mug of tea sitting in the... this is one of the secrets I'm not supposed to tell anybody. But in the Dokusan room, I came in, I got up to do Dokusan. I went into the Dokusan room. I had a big mug of tea in there, and I had a big swig of tea. Then I sat down on the cushion, and we start Dokusan. We did an hour of Dokusan, and I felt good. But when I came back after the break, I was really tired, And you have to be together when you're in Dokusan. You have to be responsive and awake. And it was very difficult. And I looked at my watch, and it said 10:15, and it was like, oh, I can make it, I think, And by the way, when I'm in Dokusan, I don't move. So when I sit down, I don't take any breaks, I promise you. Only the bodhisattvas are looking, but I do not take any breaks. I sit there the whole time. That's part of my code of honor, because I want to be focused. But I was tired. I was really tired. When I went to bed, it was like I dove into bed, and the lights were out totally, But by the end of sesshin, I find it hard to sleep. I lie down, and I think, oh, I really need to sleep, and then I realize, oh, my God, I'm totally wired. So there's this, there's this post late sesshin insomnia, and if that happens to you, just read a book, listen to the sounds, whatever, But the point is that there's so much energy to use if we're not blocked, if we're not blocking ourselves, because we've had all kinds of painful experiences, and because they get reinforced in our everyday lives. A lot of time, a lot of energy is wasted sort of restraining ourselves, really. It's like we're constantly protecting and restraining on a subconscious level, and it makes us exhausted. And when we can stop defending ourselves and stop restraining ourselves, because we're in this serenity, this beautiful, calm place, then there's like this, there can be this surge of energy, which is really, wonderful. In the Zen stories, when you read about people putting shoes on their heads or walking through doors backwards, they're really expressing this beautiful, joyous energy. That's sort of what the message of that is all about. So somebody, Guishan, sees Yangshan, and he says, "Where are you coming from?" And Yangshan says, "The field." And Guishan said, "How many people are there in the fields?" And Yangshan plants his hoe on the ground, clasping his hands, and stood there. And basically, this is like a Zen exchange. These exchanges don't make much sense as conventional stories, but basically the teacher is saying, show me your state of mind right now. Where are you coming from is a classic Zen question. You know, in the modern day, we do Dokusan, where the student comes in to see the teacher and you present your answer to your koan. You have a time, basically you have 24 hours between each Dokusan, and you can think about your answer if you want. You can try to come up with a good answer. But in the old days, people used to do a lot of work together. So, you know, basically the teacher in classical China might have just come up to you while you're working in the field, and he'll say something to test to see if you're dozing off or you're just daydreaming or something, or if you're really in the moment, you know. So this is one of these stories. So, you know, basically Guishan comes up to Yangshan and he said, "Where are you coming from?" Now, if Yangshan hadn't been in deep samadhi, he might have gone, "Huh? What do you mean? I'm right here, man." Okay? That would mean I'm not with it. Okay. So instead, Guishan comes up to Yangshan and he says, "Where are you coming from?" In other words, where, you know, show me your state of mind. Show me your mind right now. And Guishan said, "I'm coming from the fields." He's just come from the fields. And Guishan said, "How many people are there in the fields?" How would he know, right? So basically, this is a question you could say, like, this question could undermine Yangshan. So Yangshan could say, "How many people? Oh dear, I should have counted. How mindless I was, you know. I don't know, 20? What do you think?" You know. Okay. So instead, what Yangshan does is he takes his hoe and he puts it into the ground, and he clasped his hands and stood there, and he's saying with his whole body, "I'm fully here in this moment. Who cares how many people are in the field, right? I'm here now in this moment 100% without any reservations, without any expectations, without any conditions, right? And this is like 100% pure present in the moment. This takes a lot of work, but this is what he's planting his hoe, okay." And Guishan actually pays him a compliment. He says, "You know, a lot of people are not able to be fully in the moment, but basically you really are, and that's wonderful. Isn't it beautiful to be there?" And Yangshan took up his hoe and went. So everybody is doing a wonderful job with your Zen practice today. We're all, whether we're beginners or we're old hands, we're all on day two of Sesshin. We're all struggling with tired knees and inner obstacles. And you just keep returning to the breath, or returning to Mu, or returning to your koan, and trust the process, and there's going to be a transformation at some point. It's going to be like there's this tremendous compression, pressure, And it builds and builds and builds, and then all of a sudden, it's like the doors and the windows of your being are going to blow open, and the breezes are going to move smoothly, flow smoothly in and out. And this is like being united with the world after a long period of separation. And that happens sometimes dramatically, and sometimes you just feel pretty darn good, you know. But that's what this is all about. So please keep practicing with diligence. That doesn't mean ruthlessness. Be gentle to yourself. Be loving to yourself. Just make a good effort, and everything is going to work out beautifully.